Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world, from all different backgrounds, who have expertise that I do not. That's why I like to interview them. And this one's going to be fascinating. You guys know where I stand when it comes to the school system, and I'm always blown away by the tuition costs. And I'm looking at a stat here. Let me pull it up. Here it is. In 1980, the price to attend a four-year college full-time was $10,000, including tuition, fees, room and board, blah, blah, blah. By 2019-2020, the total price increased to almost $30,000. That's about 180% difference. So we have a guy who I guess has studied this. I can't wait to get into it. But David Feldman wrote a book, and let me pull it up here, Why College Costs So Much. And it is an honor to have you here, sir.
There it is.
There it is. All right. Why does it? I mean, David, why in the heck does college cost so much? Break it down for us.
You got about 3 hours.
Hey, I'm thinking it's price gouging. I'm thinking it's banks, and I'm thinking it's inflation. Those are the three. Does that summarize some of it up at least?
Inflation. Okay. Actually, one of the things that I like to say right off the bat is that anybody who says the typical college doesn't know what they're talking about, because the American higher education system is so varied, has so many niches, and what is causing things in one sector may have very little impact in other sectors. So, you know, we can break the American higher education system down at least into four separate pieces, and they operate differently. One is elite private institutions, whether they're large, Stanford, Harvard, Princeton, Duke, or small, Kenyon College, Swarthmore, Williams. That's one niche, and it's not really where America goes to school. Another niche is public flagships that are well-resourced and prestigious and very attractive to students in-state and out-of-state. Then we've got two other big niches. It is public regionals, which serve largely a middle-income audience out in the hinterlands of their states. And we've got this vast sector of small private colleges, many of whom are hanging on by their proverbial fingernails in a very tough financial environment. And then, of course, we've got the for-profits, which is, I guess, a fifth sector, one that I tend to complain about a lot. But the things that are driving price and cost in these four different sectors, there are some commonalities. I'll talk about them, but there are some big differences. The first thing that I want you and your listeners to understand is that price and cost aren't the same thing. In everyday speech, you know, we use the terms the same. You go into Burger King and you say, what did the hamburger cost? But what you're really meaning is, what price did they charge me? Yeah. The cost is the resources it took to make the hamburger, the labor costs, the beef, the electricity. The cost of higher education is, what does the institution spend to produce a year of higher education? The price is what you were charged for it. Now, in most businesses, you know, out in the private sector, they track pretty much the same. There's a slight difference, and we call it a profit margin. And profit margins, you know, they sometimes widen, and that attracts new firms in. Sometimes they go negative, and that firms leave. But by and large, price and cost move together. Higher education is a very, very different business. One of the big differences is that, you know, in contrast to Burger King, higher education is heavily subsidized. So the price that the student pays and the cost of producing the year of education can be very different. I mean, I'll start with a wonderful anecdote that, or a bit of a datum that makes eyes just sort of bug out. What does a school like Stanford or Princeton spend to produce a year of undergraduate education on average per student? You have any clue?
No, I can't even guess. What is it?
About $140,000.
What?
How? What do they charge?
It's I thought it was about 100,000. No,
it's charged about 80,000.
Yeah,
okay. I may be off by five. So wait a minute. They're providing an education that costs them 140K to produce, and they're only charging 80. And by the way, who pays that 80 or 85? All students?
No.
No, only the wealthiest. What does Stanford charge to a family that makes 60,000 a year?
Do they nothing? Is it a scholarship or what?
It's a zero. They go for free. So they're getting an education that Stanford spends $140,000 a year to produce, and they're getting it for free. And the family that makes $400,000 a year has to pay the full $80,000 for the education that costs. How is it possible for Stanford to do that?
Well,
you know, Burger King does that, they go broke.
The cost is what's scary, right? The cost, there's got to be so much pork in there. Like, what? How is it costing $140,000 to educate somebody whenever it's really a one-to-many approach with they buy their own books, they pay for their maybe their room, their room, right? If they are moving off of campus, I still don't see it. I have no idea why the cost is that much.
The big cost is not in room and board. The big cost is in what Stanford spends to provide the best faculty in the world, the best scientific equipment, the best laboratories, the best computer systems, the greatest amount of enrichment. One of the things that I show my freshman seminar, just to give them a hint of how we at William & Mary, who think we are a really good institution, simply can't afford to do the things that a place like Stanford does. I pull up a link to a wonderful little video of the Stanford Undergraduate Orchestra. By the way, is Stanford a music school that sends students to become professional musicians? Nope. No. For them, it's an enrichment activity. And it's a video of the Stanford Orchestra working carefully with, and of course, his name just flew out of my head, the composer, Elfman, Danny Elfman. Do you know Danny Elfman?
Yeah, Danny Elfman, Batman composer? Theme song. He's really good friends with Tim Burton, right? He's done many of his movies, maybe all of them.
Correct. Elfman has written a piece, and the Stanford Orchestra is premiering it and working with him on it carefully to make the final. This is something that most schools can't offer. And it's because Stanford has a gigantic endowment per student. So they can afford to spend to give students an experience with the top research faculty in the world and all of this other stuff that that most other places cannot. Now, once again, Stanford is not where America goes to school. So the fact that you and I are sitting here talking about Stanford as though it's American higher education is part of the problem. Okay. Price and cost. The price is what you pay. Cost is what the schools spend to produce a year of education. Well, the difference is subsidy. Stanford subsidizes their students largely because of Stanford's immense endowment. The flow off their endowment allows them to do things other places can't.
And explain endowment. I always thought it had to do with people who donated because they were past
yes,
members, right?
Yeah. Sure. And those donations, many of them are earmarked. Some of them are unrestricted. But what they do is they go into a very large pool that probably spins off $40,000 to $60,000 a year for Stanford to spend on students and not charge them.
Because what? Those endowments are invested and actually make money? Is that how it
goes? Those endowments are invested, and by federal law, Stanford is not allowed to treat its endowment as a piggy bank to raid however it wishes, but it can draw a float off of that endowment that is something south of 5%, like 4.8% or something of that nature. Okay. So if Stanford has a $1 billion endowment, if theirs is much larger, if they have a $1 billion endowment, they can pull 4.8% of that off and use it for their operating budget. Schools like Princeton, which has the largest endowment of any major university in the United States, Princeton has over $1 million in endowment per student. That allows them to take about $40,000 to $50,000 a year off that endowment and spend that on their students without charging them for that, which is why a school of these schools in the super elite can have a cost that's way up here and a price that's way down here.
Got it. Yeah, I heard that with I think Harvard. They have so much money in their endowment that technically they don't need anything else. I remember reading something like that, but maybe that's not the case. But there's a lot in there, right?
Every dollar matters. This goes somewhere in Harvard. But the point is that this is not where America goes to school. Most schools where Americans go don't spend $140,000 a year per student. Most schools spend much closer to what they receive from tuition and what they receive from state government. For instance, state regionals, the public regionals, they're lucky if, and I could go back and find the facts and the figures, but they're lucky if they can spend, you know, $15,000 a year per student on educational expenses, because they don't have the revenue, they don't have the resource base. So if you look at public regionals, they are far more resource starved than the big name schools that get way too much of the press. And if you look at public spending on higher education in real dollars, meaning you've netted out the impact of inflation, the amount that that states, and there is variation across the 50 states, but on average, the amount the states spend per full-time student is lower today than it was in the year 2000.
Huh.
It's been rising over the past 7 years as the economy has done well, but we are still below the level of spending from the beginning of the century. But colleges' costs haven't stayed static.
No. Yeah.
One of the things that I try to impress upon people, if you look at the price indexes for the United States or for any major country in the world, you know, everybody focuses on the CPI or the, you know, pick your price index. Price indexes are made up of other indexes. So if the CPI is essentially a mixture of two other indexes, the index for goods prices and the index of service prices. Goods are things like automobiles, groceries. Services are things like your lawyer's bill, or you pay your dentist, or you pay your charges at a school. Well, there are many more. Retailing is a service too, but I want to bring college into this because it's a service and it's a personal service, much like dentistry or medicine. If you look back over the past, as long as we've got data back into the early 20th century, service prices have been rising more rapidly than goods prices. The overall price index is an average. Over the past 30 years, goods prices have risen, but not a whole heck of a lot. Service prices have soared. Higher education is a service. So I say, if people want a one sentence explanation of why college costs rise more rapidly than the inflation rate, the answer is it's a service. All right, but that sort of still begs the question, doesn't it? Why do service prices tend to go up more rapidly than goods prices?
Hmm.
And here's an answer to that question. There's been tons and tons of labor-saving productivity over the past 100 years, right? Here's a question for you. How many people does the steel industry employ?
Not nearly as many as it did. I mean, Nippon Steel just bought U.S. Steel, so it's going down. I believe U.S. Steel went from, what, the biggest company in the world down to only producing, what, 6% of the steel in the world? So, yeah, obviously diminishing.
Diminishing numbers of people work in steel, yet the number of tons of steel that American steel factories produce is not much changed from what it was in 1960. It's a little bit lower, but then again, of course, we don't need as much steel as we did in 1960. We use composites and blah, blah, blah. But 600,000 workers in steel in 1960, 125,000 today. I could be
technology,
off by a few thousand.
Right? Technology and demand.
This is, well, set aside demand. That's not my story. My story is technological change has enabled us to produce more and more stuff per hour worked.
Got it.
But it has not enabled us to produce more and more services. Do you want to go to the doctor who sees you in the shortest amount of time.
Well,
do you?
Yeah, I see.
Do you want to go to the dentist who sees you in 5 minutes instead of 15 minutes? Do you want to go to the college who says 15-person seminars, that's passé. We're going to stuff 200 persons in a class. That would be productivity growth, right? But you, a reasonable person would say, but wait a minute, that changes the nature of the product itself. It changes
the quality of the service diminishes hands down, for sure.
Correct. So it is much harder to get productivity growth in personal services than it is in goods industries. So technological progress is not something that just sort of randomly happens across the landscape, making productivity grow in all industries. It has made productivity soar in goods industries relative to service industries, which means that the cost of providing services goes up compared to the cost of making goods.
Wait a second here. This is where I'll rebuttal. When 2020 hit, colleges went to online only, right? Why could they do it for online only and all of a sudden not have to really do that afterwards? Maybe they still do, but I think there is a way to save money. I don't know if they want to. Maybe
online education is the standard rebuttal to the argument that I've just made.
Okay, I'm not different then. All right, shit.
it is the standard rebuttal, and I'm happy to talk about the pros and the cons of online education. But let's just talk about the costs. For the most part, that online education was not cost saving; it was cost increasing.
What?
Because how did I teach my classes through COVID? The Zoom? Same way I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
On Zoom.
Yeah.
What's the primary cost of education?
The primary cost?
Me.
You.
Yeah. Paying my salary.
You. Yeah.
I was still doing all of my job. I was just doing it with a different technological medium. All right. I still had my 15-person freshman seminar. Instead of doing it in Chancellor's Hall here, I did it online via Zoom. But the college still paid my salary.
But
the college still paid my salary.
And multi-purposed. Isn't that right?
Aha. That is different. That is asynchronous. What I did was the traditional synchronous, where the students are essentially in the room with me. And the students can talk to me. I can talk to the students. The students can talk to each other. We can have live discussions. That is synchronous.
Got it.
And the cost of synchronous education did not go down. It went up because not only did the college have to pay me, they also had to hire more IT and pay Zoom. So costs actually went up. What you're talking about is asynchronous, or courses in a can, right?
Yeah. Well, not so much in a can, but courses, one to many, plus no liability, no real estate, right? Now you can offer more. You potentially can have multiple team members.
Correct.
Instead of paying for liability. So actually one to one at a higher level, potentially.
Well, it's not one to one. How has the experiment in MOOCs gone? You're familiar with the term MOOC?
No.
MOOC, massively open online class.
I don't know what the result is, but I will tell you from the entrepreneur space, we love it. That's how we grow. That's how we focus on it, get what we need, and move on.
I'll tell you, in the higher education space, it is an experiment. It works in certain circumstances, but overall, it's not a magic bullet, and it is not a disruptor.
Mm.
What MOOCs, massively open online classes, have done is open up a niche largely filled by older and returning students who are more mature and who look at education in a very instrumental way. I need skill X.
Yes, there you go. That's what I'm thinking of. Correct.
But that's not what the vast majority of America's 18 to 22-year-olds go to college for or actually need. They're still discovering who they are and what they want to be and what they want to learn and what they want to study and how to think properly.
That's what I'm saying. So here's my rebuttal. Before somebody takes out a loan for $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 for a student who really doesn't know who they are, what they want, and has no concept of money, before they do that, give them something, give them a taste, give them the online portal, the MOOC, if you will, prior to the investment. And then once that's in place, maybe so. But then once they're able to understand even this great stat that shows 52% of people graduating are not even using their degree, it might make them think differently. Therefore, they invest whenever it is necessary. So that's the way I look at it. I'm sure you have a great rebuttal, though.
Well, I am Mr. Nuance. I like to see both sides of the viewpoint. I'm not going to go into instant rebuttal mode.
Okay, it seems like you're very well educated in this, and your heart is on that side. And so I just like seeing what you're about to elaborate on, because it seems like
the evidence that the kind of asynchronous education you're talking about motivates young people just isn't there. I'll give you an example. About 5 years ago, I think it was 2015, Arizona State University, which, by the way, has a very good, reasonably large, fully online bachelor's program, which seems to have succeeded to some extent. They tried to institute a new portal to an undergraduate degree for the nation that was fully online. People would take courses in a can for their first 2 years. A year later, they abandoned it. It was an experiment that failed. A, it was expensive. B, very few students who signed up for these MOOCs actually completed the classes.
Wow.
And that's been the experience of MOOCs. Their completion rates are in the toilet. Students just don't complete them.
What's the difference between that and cyber school for high school? I have individuals on my team that went to cyber. They always call it cyber. And number one, they did really well and they loved it. And I guess maybe they were perfectly set up to do the online college. They just never went and did it. So is there a difference?
Well, Are you familiar with the term selection bias?
No.
Are the people who work with you a random slice of the U.S. population?
No.
Okay.
That is a selection bias. I guess that's probably the way you're looking at it. I'm attracting a certain group. There you
correct.
Go.
Correct. The kind I'm never going to say never that. That online education is never good for anyone. No, there is a slice of the population, even a slice of young people, who are drawn to that method, who are focused, know how to use the technology, and motivated. What I'm saying is that the younger you get, the smaller the slice of the population that thrives in that environment.
Wow. That's incredible. I'm just thinking everybody's born with one of these in their hands. At 4 years old, they're playing on this nonstop. I'm thinking that the world is going towards these type of people. Never leave their house. Go anywhere. Let me learn everything from the phone. No, I guess
we'll see how much they actually learn. Remember, there's an awful lot of neuroscience evidence that that these devices are not particularly good for comprehension and attention spans.
Well, I will tell you, I went to college. I went to Duquesne University, and I didn't learn shit. All right, I wish they had online. Just so you know, that's the way I look at it.
No. Once again, the point I try to make over and over again is that this vast higher education system is heterogeneous, as is the population that attends it. What I try to caution people not to do is make strong, wild generalizations.
Mm. Okay. What about a return on investment? Are you seeing a great return on investment? Because I don't see it. And maybe I'm wrong. Elon Musk is very famous for saying, I'm not even hiring college graduates anymore. So is it as popular? I don't think it is. Well, are you noticing any type of return?
I am sure the people who are working hard to design Starship are high school dropouts. I'm really sure of that.
Well, I guess, maybe that's not the case for every part of his companies, but I would think that he has pretty high level stuff. But for him to say he does not evaluate a hire based off of their college anymore, I mean, that's pretty eye-opening, am I right? And so return on investment is not
Bill Gates recommended my book, not Elon Musk.
Yeah. Guys, by the way, look at his book. There's a testimonial from Bill Gates on it. So holy smokes. Bill on here. Let's see. I'd like to hear what he has to say about my opinions. Anyways, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Return on investment. On average, college pays off tremendously.
Really?
Does it pay off for everybody? No, of course not. There's a distribution. A lot of people go to college for a semester, to a 4-year or to a 2-year, or a year, decide because, you know, the rubber meets the road, that it's not for them, and leave. Often they wind up with $5,000 or $10,000 in student loan debt to do that. That is a social problem. But actually, I don't think it's a terrible idea that the deepest pocket in the country allows people to take low-cost risks like that, because the reward to the individuals and to the nation as a whole of the successes that come out of people who start that way is pretty big. See now how I get into the loan debt issue?
Yeah, I'm glad you talk a little bit about money there, because holy smokes, why is it the only loan that you can't ever escape? No matter what, no matter your financial problems, you will never be able to escape school debt, right? You can't BK out of it. But
you know why that's the case?
No, I don't know.
Well, it is, we would not have a good financial way for anyone who is not upper middle class to finance higher education, but for a loan system of the sort that we have. And the reason is that there are huge market failures in lending for higher education. When you go out and not you, when the hypothetical you goes out and tries to get a car loan, of course they're going to look at your credit rating, but often it's very easy to get a loan on a car. And there's a very good reason for that. When you buy the car, if you stop making payments, what happens?
They will repossess it, I believe. Aha! I believe.
Aha! There's collateral.
Pretty soon, too.
There's collateral there. Yeah. All right? Take out a mortgage on a house. Same deal, right?
Yep. There's an asset for sure.
You're an 18-year-old and you say to a bank, I want a loan to go to college. And the bank is going to say, uh-uh, you're too high a risk. You have no collateral. All right. You know, maybe your parents can put something up for you, but if you're not a wealthy family, there's no collateral there. Can the bank ensure that you take major X instead of that will allow you to pay off a loan instead of major Y, which is what you really want to do? No, the bank can't enforce that. The return to an undergraduate degree or a 2-year degree, the average return would easily justify a loan. But there's such a variance, there's such a spread that banks don't take that risk. So who steps in to fill the void? It's the deep pocket. Well, but the deep pocket wants to be paid back too. So it's the federal government that has made the decision that you cannot easily discharge student loan debt in bankruptcy like you can discharge credit card debt in bankruptcy.
How much is the government involved in certain colleges? Have you noticed any type, other than the fact that, yeah, they're saying you can't get a loan until, or if you take a loan, there's no way out of it. How much are they involved? I think they're involved quite a bit, and that's why there's such a political lean in most colleges. But is there anything that you could share with us that kind of shows how much the government is involved financially?
Well, you know the size of the government's student loan portfolio. I don't know what it is, somewhere between $1 and $1.5 trillion these days. But the part of the problem is that the colleges are not involved. The colleges are on the outside. The student takes out the loan and gives the money to the college as tuition payments. And the colleges actually some of the reform proposals would put colleges on the hook, not for the whole size of the loan, but just for enough of it so that it would concentrate the it's called risk sharing. That colleges, if a student goes into non-repayment for a certain number of months, the college would be on the hook for a certain fraction of the student's loan debt. The purpose there would be to ensure that colleges would proverbially look over the shoulder of students to make sure that they were not borrowing unwisely, because heck, if they default, the college is liable for some of the problem. So the problem is not that colleges are involved; it's the problem is that they're not involved enough. Hmm. The other thing is that if you look at where the student loan debt problem is, if you're going to call it a problem, it's lodged in two sources. Number one is for-profit institutions. The average amount of student debt that students take out to go to for-profit institutions is substantially higher than it is at the nation's 2 and 4 year institutions, and the return on investment is much lower.
Really? So who's a for-profit? Who's a very famous for-profit college?
Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
Corinthian. But that's just the public face. There are an awful lot of small for-profits that never hit the radar screens, but which are accredited and students can get Pell Grants and student loans and go to them. The for-profit sector is itself varied. But on average, the return on investment at for-profits is low and the student debt is high. The other area where there's a tremendous amount of student loan debt is in graduate school. Hmm. And most of the $100,000 to $200,000 student loan debt problem is at graduate school, not undergrad. There are, you can find anecdotes. You can find undergraduates who borrowed $110,000 to get a worthless degree. Yes, you can find that. But the vast majority of the heavily indebted student population is not undergraduates, it's graduate students. That's actually less of a problem because a statistic that people find mind-blowing. If you look at the size of student debt as it grows, you know, if you put it in bins, students with 20,000 debt, 40,000, 60,000, 80,000, the income of those people rises with the amount they borrow. What are graduate students borrowing $150,000 borrowing for? What kinds of degrees?
Yeah, I would think doctors and lawyers right there, right?
And MBAs.
Yeah.
These are programs that this is not where your student loan default problem comes from. The most likely student defaulter is a student with $5,000 or $10,000 in debt. Huh. It's the small amounts. Remember what I told you earlier? It's the students who try college and fail.
Got it.
There, that's where the bulk of your student loan debt default problem is. People with $120,000 in debt and a medical degree aren't defaulting. And by the way, this is where I'm going to sound like I'm on the right as opposed to on the left, which is where I normally am. The idea that we should wipe out the debt of the next generation's doctors, lawyers, and MBAs.
Which is insane. Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
I am much more content with a Biden-esque proposal to knock $10,000 off. That would eliminate the debt of a huge percentage of the borrowers. And it would clean the slate for the people who society, government, everybody has said, take a chance. All right, they took a chance. It didn't work. But once again, once you get up into $30,000 of debt, the average amount of debt that students at public and private universities take out now who get a degree is somewhere in the high 20s for the publics and the low 30s for the privates. This is like a car loan. With a degree, these are not amounts of debt that are strangling us.
Well, even if you take on that much debt, internally, what's happening is saying your soul says, I need to take on certain roles that pay me at least a fighting chance to pay it down. So maybe you take bigger shots at a certain career path that
Correct.
Will create an income. And so
Correct.
Maybe that's the case, right? It's there's a resistance and you have to kind of match it to some degree.
Well, the evidence suggests that modest amounts of student loan debt coupled with a degree don't have negative impacts on things like marriage, family formation, purchasing a house, things of that nature. That was a great article in the American Economic Review on that one just last month. The kind of debt that is life-changingly bad is the kind of debt that students have who acquire no credential whatsoever to pay it off. And that's usually smaller amounts of debt. Once again, can you find people with $60,000 of student loan debt that has reverse amortized to $130,000? Yes, you can find people who have either made very bad choices, fallen through some very big cracks. Yes, you can find evidence for that. But on average, one of the things that loan debt does also, I'm sure you're quite familiar with the concept of skin in the game.
Yeah, of course. I agree. You need to have skin in the game before what you pay for usually leads to what you pay attention to. Right. That's it.
Correct. Which is one of the reasons why the for-profit side of schools leads to such a low payoff, because most students don't think there's any skin in the game because it's the government that's paying. They forget that they've borrowed the money.
Yes.
But if you look at the revenue stream of most for-profits, it is 80% to 95% government money.
I didn't know that. I got to look into that one.
In the form of Pell Grants, student loans, and GI benefits. Most for-profits, it's 80% to 95% of all their, meaning that families writing checks is almost none of their money.
Well, it does tie with that great quote about a mouse will die in the mousetrap because it doesn't understand why the cheese is free. And once you realize that anything that's free is usually going to lead to some type of trap, then all of a sudden it kind of wakes you up. So without having an investment or any type of cost, I agree with you, you will not pay attention, but you more so, you will not respect it. You will not value it. And that's a great point what you said there.
I am not an enemy of student loans. I am a friend of making colleges inform their students so that they don't overborrow, so that they are aware of the financial consequences of what they're doing. And if the schools are on the hook for a small slice of their failures, they will do a much better job of helping students navigate a complex process. Mm.
And so you bring up a very good point about the individuals out there wanting their student loans to be paid for. So it's people like me and other individuals who will say school is not a great investment. It doesn't have a great return on investment. So don't go to it. But the people who are saying, let's go to it, and then they get out of school and they say, I'm not making enough for me to pay down my loan. Somebody else come and save me. We're like, oh, see, that's proof, right? That's a bad investment. So it only adds fuel to our fire and gives us ammunition, the way I look at it.
But you're not looking at a random slice of college graduates.
Well, I guess I'm looking at people who are following the CNN MSNBC model, where it's always someone else's fault. And maybe that's the way to look at it.
I mean, once again, and I can send you the literature. On average, the return on investment from a college degree is one of the best investments you can make. I mean, the most estimates of the return on a college degree are in the 12 to 15% range. This is pretty good investment. Now, once again, is that saying that everybody, that college is a great financial investment for everybody? No, ex post, some people make mistakes.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm just in a lot of circles. Maybe what you said renders quite true, the selection bias for me, right? I'm around a certain group of people that see individuals go from high school into college, take on $50,000 in debt, get out, have no clue who they are, what they want, but have to take a job to pay down this golden loans, ultimately leading to more liabilities, more debt, and therefore they're stuck in this rat race for the rest of their life. So we always try to, you know, wake them up beforehand. And I believe one way to wake people up is to give them as much education for as low cost without much debt early on, and then potentially signing up for a
for that sort of student. We have community colleges.
There you go.
The community college is a perfectly fine route to go 2 years of community college and then finish up at a 4-year institution. That's a great alternative. Many states are creating flavors of free community college programs that are changing at the margin some people's decisions of how to take that pathway, go directly to a four-year institution or go two-year and then four-year. You're not the first person to have noticed that that for some students, especially the ones who are price sensitive, that the two-year route is a great way to go.
Yeah. Maybe I should have done that, but I was caught in the trap of, let me have the college experience, right? That's what we're all saying. Let me go and party. Let's drink it up. Let's have a good time. And if I miss out on that, man, I will never forgive myself. So maybe that was my fault. And I think that a lot of people, adopt that same philosophy. But I have to ask you before we wrap up here today, how in the heck did you get Bill Gates to read this book and give you a testimonial? Whose nephew are you, sir? I mean, who?
You don't have to believe me. That was completely a bolt out of the blue. I was sitting at my computer one day, and a former student of my co-author shot him an email and said, "Did you see this?" And then he came over and tapped me on the shoulder, and it was like, "Holy! I don't know Bill Gates. Sorry." That was just completely out of the blue.
So he read your book, he gave a testimonial, and you don't even owe him your soul or anything. That is amazing, man.
Bill Gates is a voracious reader. He must read 80, 90 dense books a year. And he may read more, but then he selects and he picks and he reviews. So the man probably has an eidetic memory and is a speed reader, but he's unlike many people out there in the techosphere, he is a voracious reader.
Wow. Fascinating, man. I saw that right away and I'm like, all right, we got to have this guy on the podcast. But outside of your own book, one question we always ask our guests, is there one that maybe puts you on this path to become a professor or just help you, in any shape and form, a defining moment, if you will?
You're asking if there's a person that got me into.
Is there a book that stands out in your life?
Is there a book that did this?
Yeah. So I always talk about Rich Dad Poor Dad as a book that changed my life, and it just made me see things in a different way. It made me who I am. That's why it's behind me spinning right now.
I see that,
mesmerizing you. Hopefully,
see that.
And so I owe a lot of my success to that book. And so, is there anything like that that stands out in your life that puts you on this path? Maybe
I'm going to disappoint you. I'm going to disappoint you. It wasn't books that did this. It was people that did this.
Really?
Yes. It was advisors. It was other professors who said, think about this in a different way. Now, I'm sure they pushed a wide variety of books on me, but there wasn't a single text that did this. It was just an extended conversation with people. By the way, you know what that's called? College. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, there's masterminds too that do the same thing. That's not college. Masterminds still cost money. So I'm not against spending money for anything. So if it's $100,000 to join, I want to get a return on investment of $400,000. So if it leads to something, then it's an asset. But if the average person goes to college and it doesn't produce wealth or freedom or any type of real income, then it's a liability. So I'm all for paying for things. It's just, what is the return? And maybe that's where my heart's at. So fascinating. You're an interesting guy. You're fun to talk to for sure, man.
Can I advertise my second book?
Yes, please do so.
Let's make it readable here.
The Road Ahead for America's Colleges and Universities. All right.
That's the follow-up to Why Does College Cost So Much? This is getting a little old. It's from 2017, but man, I think I've got my predictions. My predictions have stood up.
Okay. Any last thoughts on that? Is there a prediction that is coming true or just came true or about to come true that you could share with us?
You remember the discussion that we had about the failure of online and asynchronous MOOC
courses? Oh, yes. You're saying there's
to take over the world? Yeah, when I wrote that book, there were so many people saying that face-to-face education is in the toilet, and in 25 years, there won't be any bricks and mortar institutions left. I called Buffalo Chips on that and explained why in that book.
So Bill Gates is instrumental, I guess, in the AI. I think AI is going to take over a lot. Are you afraid of AI interfering with how the education system runs right now?
Once again, I'm not going to give you a clear answer. I'm going to give you a pros and a cons.
You have people putting on masks right now, and they're living in their own worlds in their apartments.
I'm not going to do that in my class. Not in my class. I think AI is a fabulous, fabulous aid for learning. It's also a dangerous thing, too. It's a fabulous aid for things like technical learning. AI can help a student learn how to code in Stata or other programs really effectively. It's terrible if students think that it's a way to avoid learning how to write well.
Mm. Great point there. Yes.
Pros and cons.
Man, writing has done so much wonder for my life. It gave me clarity. It gave me self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And so there's no way around it. You have to do the hard work. And I think a lot of people are trying to get around that or fall into the trap of, well, I'll just have ChatGPT created for me. And there's no thinking or there's no thought process involved. And it just doesn't work that way. Once again, if the cheese is free...
I get in my first year students' faces all the time. I am working on their writing. A 15-person writing intensive class. You know, maybe that's why college costs so much.
Now that right there is the clip right there. Perfect, man. Thank you so much for your time today. Guys, check it out. His book's online. Is there a social media channel that you recommend? I would assume LinkedIn, but are you a Twitter guy?
I'm a Twitter guy. Yeah. I'm a Twitter guy and a Blue Sky guy.
Okay. So easy to find you on there, right?
Very David Feldman. Yeah. @DHFeld1. I'm easy.
Well, are you a Seinfeld guy at all?
Yeah.
Okay. So there was an episode where there was Bizarro Jerry, and in Jerry's world was pretty much, there was two different sets of people. So there was Kramer, and then the Bizarro Jerry world was, there was a guy named Feldman. So when I first saw your name, I'm like, oh my God, hopefully he's a Seinfeld guy that gets that reference. Are you familiar with that at all?
I don't, but what I do remember, you remember Gary Larson and
yes.
and his fabulous one panel cartoons.
Oh wait, no, actually I don't.
Oh, Gary Larson, the Far Side cartoons.
Far Side. Oh, the Far Side. Yes. I've heard that
the
name.
Far
before.
Side. He had two or three cartoons with a Professor Feldman.
Oh, okay.
Inevitably a bumbling idiot. I loved it.
Well, you're a professor with a personality, man. I'm sure you're a great educator. So thanks so much for your time today. Really, I got to look into some of these things. I'm going to check out Phoenix maybe I'll be able to be a little bit more wise when it comes to bashing higher education. So I appreciate your insight today.
Thank you much.
All right, guys, remember, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.